He became the world's greatest athlete when he won the decathlon in the 1956 Olympics. But unlike other Olympic heroes, that was not the ticket to everlasting fame and fortune. After getting his gold in Australia, the former Indiana University athlete set world records in the hurdles and finished the stint in the Navy. He then joined the Cleveland Browns as a fifth-round draft pick, but lasted just one season because he dared to violate social mores at the time. He completed his football career in Canada, selling encyclopedias in the summer months to supplement his income, and then returned to New Jersey to help develop an alternative school for urban youth. His career has taken him to a lot of places, and he's cleared a lot of hurdles. So let's get back to it. I'm Mark Monteith, and once again, I'm going one-on-one with Milt Campbell.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions. They make your memories last forever.
Do I understand correctly that the 1956 Olympics in Australia were the last ones that were not televised live?
Well, yeah.
Nobody back home was seeing this, right?
Games. There wasn't that much television. One of the reasons for that was the Australians built a tremendous stadium and area for the media. And then they wanted to charge the media for using part of the stadium.
Uh-huh.
And the media said, we've never paid to use anybody's stadium, so we're not going to pay to use this one. So most of the films that were being shot by the Australians. So if you want to get some film of Milt Campbell and the decathlon, you have to pretty much go to Bud Greenspan or go down to Australia and look through their 20 million feet of film. And you pick out what you want to get and pay them for it, and you get a chance to use it, I guess.
Yeah, nobody back home is seeing this. I'm guessing after you win, do you call back home to tell them that you won it, or how did they?
Yeah, they would get the information over the radio and over the being in newspapers and so forth. But I called back home and I said it's mine, you know, because when I left to go to the Olympic Games, I called my mother up, you know, and I said, "Hey, Mom," I said, "I'm on the team." I said, "We're getting ready to go. I'm leaving the naval base right now. I'm going up to Los Angeles to, get the plane to Australia." And she said, "Now, Milt," she says, she got ready to tell me, "Now, Milt, I don't want you to go out and hurt yourself. And if your breathing isn't right, remember you had a heart murmur." And I hung up the phone on her.
She's worried about your health.
I said, just before I hung it up, I said, Mom, and I stopped her from, you know, talking. She says, "What?" I said, "Mom, if I don't win this thing, I'm coming back in a box." And she said, "Now, Milt?" And I said, "Bye." And I hung up the phone on her.
Oh, wow.
I got home, the first thing she said to me, "Don't you ever hang up a phone on me."
You
know? And then she put her arms around me and started crying and said, "Good, congratulations." You know?
Oh, that's great. That's like out of a movie or something.
Well, that's a mom for you.
Yeah. Now, you say you had a heart murmur.
I had some sort of I had chicken pox, measles, mumps, everything when I was a kid. And very young, I can remember standing in the window with measles, watching my brother and my father and my grandfather going out. They were going saltwater fishing, you know, and I couldn't go, and I was standing there crying and everything, you know. So it was, I caught everything.
Okay. So it's a long flight to Australia, especially in 1956.
And 26 hours.
26 hours. Well, what was it like going back home, having won the gold medal?
It was phenomenal. I mean, I don't think I was on a high until after I got back home, and I was able to do something that I had made up my mind way back when I was in grammar school. I had a teacher in grammar school. I got into a fight in grammar school, and I beat this kid up. So when we went to the principal office, the principal was he grabbed me by the arm, and he kind of turned me towards the wall, and he raised his hand. And at that time, my brother and my two cousins came around the hall, and they yelled at him, and they said, "If you drop your hand on him, we'll drop you all over the school."
Mm.
So I went back to my classroom, and my teacher said, that I would never be anything as long as my brother was alive. And I just turned and I looked at him and I thought, again, there's another Milt Campbell motivation. It was deep down inside of me. All I could think of was, I'll show you. And Mr. Bethesda was a good teacher. He was just, at that particular moment, he said the wrong thing. But at that particular moment, he said the right thing to the right kid.
Because it motivated you, mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I came back when I won the silver medal, and I came back to his class. I came back during the daytime when he was in class. I opened the door of his class, and I stood in front of his class and in front of him. And he said, oh, my goodness, I owe you an apology. And I said, you don't owe me anything, but you will when I'm the best athlete in the world. And I turned around and I walked out of his office, out of his classroom. Then in 1956, I came back again. And I walked in his classroom and he cried. He started crying. He said, I must apologize to you. And I told him, I said, I'm glad you don't apologize to me. You motivated me.
Yeah.
I told him, I said, because of you, I had a target for the rest of my life. And I was going to prove it to you.
That's great. Did they have a parade for you, anything like that?
Oh, yeah, they had a parade, the Milt Campbell parade, you know, and it was great. It was phenomenal. It was phenomenal to see that, you know, your whole hometown came out to, you know, lining the streets and everybody, and you saw everybody, and you thought, hey, wow, you know, you must have done something, guy.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of looking at all the guys that you ran with and that you hung out with and, you know, guys that were sitting around and you were telling them you were going to do this. And they, that Johnson kid is really great. You know, he's a world record holder. How are you going to do this? And then it came down to the point of when I went away, there were a couple of people that bet against me, you know.
Yep.
I came back home and the guys, it was all about teasing the guys that bet against me now.
Yeah,
and how much money they lost in that day.
I think every great athlete has people back in his hometown who either bet against him or don't believe in him, and that's just a reflection of their own, you know, lack of confidence or whatever.
Believe in him, you know, it might be they don't believe in him to the point that he's going to beat this particular guy or that. But I've got guys back in my hometown that used to look at me and say, I can still outrun you. I mean, come on, boy, let's get out in the street now. I'll show you. You know.
Sure.
And the thing of it is, and kids say to me, well, were there guys back that could beat you? I said, yeah. I said, the only difference between them and me is that I stuck with it and they didn't.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. I said there were a lot of great athletes back in those days, and you can always find somebody back there that could wrestle a little better than you or do something a little better than you, you know.
Yeah, but they didn't have the motivation.
Yeah.
You did not go back to college, right?
No, I didn't.
So you really only spent 2 years at Indiana.
Right.
So what's next after winning the gold medal? I know you're drafted in the NFL draft in 1957, but was there anything there? What do you do when you get back home after winning that gold medal in Australia?
Well, I wish I knew what I knew now. And I can very much say that I would have turned around and gone back to Indiana for one more year and then gone into professional sports.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you got to remember the times way back then. 10, 15 grand was a lot of money. And it was easy to coach, you know, a kid into playing football. And let's face it, I wanted to do something I could do. And I thought I could do well. So now was the time to do that, you know. And, you know, I always had enough confidence in myself that I knew I could go off and get a good job and work and, you know, and have a great time at that. But I just wanted the opportunity and time to, to go to the Cleveland Browns and have a roommate like Jim Brown and get an opportunity to play on that team. Hey, you pack up and go.
Yeah. So the Olympics are what, August, September of 56? Something like that.
July and August.
Okay, July and August, and you're back home. Basically, are you back home until the NFL draft comes around in the spring of 57? Or?
No, actually, what happened was the Australian Games wasn't over until November.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but that's their summer. Their summer runs, from November, I think, till January.
Okay.
February, March, something like that.
Okay. So you were there in November in Australia.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you don't have that much time. You're home. I know, you, like we said before, you did set the world record indoors and out in the hurdles in 1957.
Yeah, I set the world's record indoors, and then we ran outdoors, and I set the world's record outdoors. And then after I set the world's record outdoors, the next week I pulled a leg muscle running on the grass, and I guess then I put in for a hardship dependence discharge to get discharged from the Navy, and the Navy discharged me, and I went to Cleveland.
Campbell's gold medal doesn't bring him the fame and fortune that it did other athletes. We'll explore why when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith, spending this hour with Olympic gold medalist and former IU athlete, Milt Campbell. Winning a decathlon usually brings fame and fortune for Olympians, but it didn't work out that way for Campbell. He did, however, get a shot at the NFL, but only a brief one. Did you ever compete in another decathlon after the Olympics?
No. Been there, done that.
No interest.
What I wanted to do.
And you kind of fell through the cracks because Bob Mathias in 1952, he becomes a movie star. You know, there's literally a movie about himself, right, that he stars in.
Right.
And Bob Richards, who won the pole vault in 1952, is on Wheaties boxes.
Right.
I think he won in 56. And Rafer Johnson moving ahead in 1960 because those Olympics are, they receive more media coverage in the United States and so forth. He gets a lot of attention. But Milt Campbell in 1956, you kind of went unnoticed, didn't you?
Well, I kind of went unnoticed, and you know, we blame a lot of it on the media and the fact that the Australians didn't get, the media didn't get out a lot of stuff. But, you know, I turn around and I say a little bit of that is, I think, the prejudice that ran through America.
Sure. Hey, we're talking the 1950s, so sure.
A little bit of that because, hell, you knew who the 100-yard dash champion was. You know what I mean? You knew who the pole vault champion was.
Yeah.
How come you don't know who the world's greatest athlete is?
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, it's just, it was a stage and a time of some tough things to take. But, you had to take them and you had to move on.
Was that a disappointment to you at the time? Were you expecting more for your accomplishment?
Believe it or not, I was not, because my coach had already prepared me for the fact that he said that I would never get the recognition and that I deserved, and he didn't think it would happen in my life, in his lifetime or my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was preparing me for prejudiceness and so forth.
Yeah.
And as a young kid, I remember him sitting to one day, and we were sitting on the track, and he said, "I just want you to know that you're never going to get the recognition that you deserve."
Now, this coach is white, right?
Yes, he is white.
Yeah.
Yes, he's white. And he turned around, I turned around, and I said, "Well, I'll just keep on beating him, coach." He said, "You're going to beat a hell of a lot of people." He said, "It's not that I worry about." He said, "I just want you to be prepared." You know, and when I didn't get the recognition, did it hurt? Yeah, it hurt, you know. If we talk about it long enough, you hear the anger in my voice and everything, you know, because what the hell, I did everything everybody else did. I did it in as fine a fashion, if not better. I mean, I literally had people, this kid that won this time, broke the world's record and everything, Ashton Eaton. He's talking to me and my lady, and what does he say? He said, "My uncle, or his grandfather, played football at Michigan. And he said, my grandfather said that if you want to know a real decathlete, he said, talk to Milt Campbell."
Ah, there you go.
You know, so, you know, it's people were proud. And, you know, I hear things like this here, and I say to myself, fine, I did my contribution. I did what I wanted to do. You know, nobody asked me to do this. I did it for me. I did it for America. I did it for Mom. I did it for apple pie. And I'm very proud that I did do it.
Milt Campbell, gold medalist in the 1956 Olympics, with us today on One-on-One. Given the racism of that time, are you able to feel patriotic spirit when you accomplish something like that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because, you know, you're kind of thrown in the eyes of all of those that are prejudiced. Because they're kind of like sitting back saying, well, you know, our black kid doesn't have this, doesn't have that, you know what I mean? Hell, you didn't let me swim in swimming pools. Maybe that's why a lot of us couldn't swim.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I could swim, and I am going to be the best swimmer I can be, and I became an All-American swimmer.
Mm-hmm.
I just got also inducted into the International Swimmers Hall of Fame.
Oh, that's right. You're in the Swimming Hall of Fame.
Right.
That's amazing.
So, you know, again, when you step out into the arena, we knew what we were doing. Wilt Chamberlain, Jim Brown, all of us, we knew what we were up against.
Yeah.
We knew what we were doing. But, you know, we look at Jackie Robinson, we look at the ones that came before us, and we said, you know, they picked up the sledgehammer. We have to now break down these barriers. And we knew what we were doing. It's just like playing football at Indiana University. I never talked back to a coach in all my life. But at that point, I could not take what was being done. You know what I mean? And also, you know, if you had the attitude that I had, my attitude was to win. I don't care. You take out all stops to win. Okay? That's what I was about. Okay, and you work hard and you do everything that you can do to do it. And when you see something that nobody else sees and you can't even talk to them about it, you know, why am I on this team? You know, why am I on this team? And then you turn around and you do it. And heaven knows I broke my finger when I caught that ball.
Oh, did you? In Michigan? At Michigan?
Yeah.
You broke your finger?
I broke my finger when I caught that ball. If I had to drop that ball, woo, I could see myself going back home from New Jersey.
Oh, boy. Yeah, you would have been walking somewhere.
But I tell you, as much as that hurt, I held on to that ball, you know, and then I turned around, and as I was coming back up the field, I dropped it in the end zone and came up the field, and we won the game.
In the NFL, you, as we said, you're drafted in the fifth round of the 1957 draft. Jim Brown was the first-round pick that year.
Right.
You two roomed together.
Yeah.
As rookies, you're probably, not many blacks on the team then, are there?
No, there weren't. I think there were about six of us, maybe.
Yeah. So you guys roomed together.
Yeah.
As everybody knows, Jim Brown's, you know, perhaps the greatest running back of all time in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your rookie season with the Browns.
My rookie season was a hard one. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I got discharged out of the Navy in San Diego. And the Cleveland Browns were playing the Los Angeles Rams. So I went up, and, of course, I go to the locker room and everything and meet everybody. And Paul Brown said, okay, I'm glad you're here. You're out of the Navy. So you can go back with us on the plane and everything. And I said, yeah, fine, everything. I said, I just got to leave my car with my friends here, and I'll get it later. And Paul Brown said to me, he said, well, okay, here's what I want you to do now. He says, I want you to come down and sit on the bench with the team. And I said, oh, okay. I thought that was great. And then I come into the locker room when the guys are, you know, getting dressed and getting training, and I see a locker, and it says Campbell, and it's got all this equipment hanging up in it. You know, and I sit there, and I'm saying, okay, maybe there's another Campbell on the team. So I'm looking around and so forth, and he said, that's your stuff. He said, if you're going to sit on the bench, you got to put the uniform on. So I said, okay, so I put the uniform on. I don't tie up anything because I'm not going to play. All of a sudden, I'm sitting on the bench. I hear, Campbell, why don't run this kickoff back? So I look up the bench. I look down the bench. I'm looking for another Campbell. And he points to me, and he said, I mean you. So I tie up my shoes, you know, I tie up the rest of the stuff, you know, and I start running out on the field, you know, with a helmet. I don't even know which way to carry the ball, and what they say, we're going to open it up down the middle, you just run it up there. So they kick it off, and who do they kick it to? But they kick it to the rookie that they haven't seen and got no reports on or nothing else, right?
Yep.
So I catch the ball, I'm headed upfield, and I get away from this, and I get away from that. Next thing you know, I hit about the 40-yard line. It was like I ran into a brick wall going full speed. So I get up, and the ball moved from my lower waist to my chest, almost like I was going to fumble it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm coming out. As I'm coming out, I'm seeing stars, you know. You know, you see those light flashes from your eyes when you've been hit too hard.
Yeah.
And I'm passing Paul Brown. He looked at me and he said, if you had to fumble that ball, you'd been looking for another job.
And you had not played in a football game in what, 2 years at that time?
Or? 2 years. Yeah, 2 years. I hadn't played in a football game, you know. And which, if you talk to Jim Brown, he'll tell you that it was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it was wrong just to bring me in like that.
Well, sure. You hadn't practiced.
He went back to Cleveland and, you know, I got beat up there pretty good a couple of times, you know, and by the end of the season, I was beaten back and holding my own.
Because you hadn't had a training camp or anything.
I hadn't had a training camp. We went back. There was only, one more game to play, exhibition. So we played that exhibition game, and then I had made the team. I guess he saw something there. And it was just that shock of coming on the team like that. Put me back about 6 months.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just, I mean, I didn't have the mentality for football.
Now, you'd been in track for 2 years.
Yeah, I hadn't been in track for the last 2 years, so it was really a conditioning mentality I had. I wasn't tough. I wasn't, my muscles weren't hard, you know what I mean? I didn't have the mentality to try and run over you. It was a mentality of trying to run away from you, you know, and that type of thing. And around the end of the season, in the middle of the season, it began to come back to me.
Did you have some good games late in the year?
No, I didn't. Paul didn't play me that much.
Okay. You felt like you were back in the football groove at least, huh?
Yeah, I was getting back in the football groove because I didn't mind banging, you know what I mean? The other times I was banging going home and, you know, getting in the whirlpool and that type of thing, trying to get the soreness out and so forth, you know, and just generally getting mentally ready.
Yeah.
Thing, you know, you develop mentalities for certain things, like a boxer. Who the hell can develop a mentality for somebody hitting them in the face?
Yeah.
You know, but you develop that mentality for boxing if you're a boxer. To do that, but in football is an aggressive, hostile mentality, and you can't be out of it 2 years and then just come back to the game.
Campbell gets released by the Browns and takes his game and family to Canada when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, I'm Mark Monteith. Keep in mind, podcasts for all the One-on-One episodes can be heard on our website at 1070thefan.com. Click on shows, click on weekly shows, and click on the One-on-One link, and you can listen 24/7. Now, back to former IU athlete and Olympic gold medalist Milt Campbell, who wound up taking his game to the Canadian Football League. But after that rookie year with the Browns, you get married to a white woman, and lo and behold, you're cut before the following season, correct?
Well, yeah, I'm cut just before the following season. Yeah. You know, I played the last game. I had a great game. The guy, when we came off the field, the guy said, we finally got the backfield we want, Bobby Mitchell, you, and Jim Brown.
You're talking about the last preseason game?
Last preseason game. And I had a lot of the guys that had been there 8-9 years come off the field and say, hey, we're glad you made it. You know, and that type of thing. Because, again, when I came back, Paul made me practice both ways, but he didn't play me. And then I finally go to his office just before the last game, and I said to him, Coach Brown, I'd like to talk to you. And he said, okay. He says, so what's the matter? I said, Coach, if you're not going to play me, I wish you just cut me, okay? I said, because I practice hard every day for you. I've done everything that you said. You know, I'm not the smartest guy in the world about the plays and all that, but I said, I do whatever you say. And I said, if you're not going to play me, I said, I'd rather be cut. So he said to me, don't worry about it. You're going to play half the game on against the Chicago Bears. And so played the game, had a very good game. You know, and very supportive as fullback, and Jim Brown then played the other part of the game fullback. And the next day I got cut. And I never seen Paul Brown, incidentally, again in all my life, except to see him over television or something like that.
Yeah, so he did not tell you that you were cut?
No, they gave me a letter.
Gave you a letter?
Yeah, they call you to the office, they give you a letter, and I sat there for a whole day waiting to go in the office to talk to him, and then they said, well, Mr. Brown's left by out the back door, so so I said, okay. So I left and just, but the thing that I guess hurt most of all was that the Giants had mentioned Paul Brown has three fullbacks, and he has to cut one of them, okay, according to building his team. And he had Jim Brown, who he wasn't going to cut. He had Edmond Gillespie, which was a 10-year fullback for him, and he had me. And so he cut me, and the Giants said, whichever one he cuts, we'll pick up. Okay, so I knew I was going to go to the Giants. And so I got cut, and I called the Giants when I was in Cleveland, and the coach said to me, he says, okay, he says, I need to talk to Paul to make sure you're not put on waivers or, you know, make sure the Browns are not asking anything for you, okay, and then we can sit down and talk. And I said, okay, I'm going to drive back to Jersey, and I'll call you tomorrow from Jersey. So I drive back to Jersey, and evidently he's talked to, I got back too late to call him, but the next day I called him. And I must have called him about, in the next 2 days, I must have called him about 13 times. And they let me hang on the phone for 45 minutes, for an hour, for half an hour. You know, the coach will be right here, don't worry about it, you know. And it just got to the point where I said, the hell with it, I know what's going on.
Yeah, you were blackballed.
Right.
Because you had married a white woman?
Right. I believe so.
Yeah.
And when people say, wow, you know, that's kind of strong to even think that way. Okay, I'm the world's greatest athlete, but I can't get a job in America doing what I can do best.
Because at that time, that was pretty much unheard of. It was.
Right. So, anyhow, the next morning, Ralph Sazio is standing in my bedroom, and he says, come on, get dressed. He says, I'm going to take you to Canada. You're going to play football up in Canada. And I said, oh, no, I had enough of this nonsense. I said, you know, I've done in life what I wanted to do, and what I really wanted to do is prove that I was a great athlete. And I said, I've done what I wanted to do. And he said, no, come on. We'll give you a great contract and everything. So I get dressed, and I go to Canada. I mill around with them for half a day, you know, fighting over a contract, so we sign a contract. And then I go back to Cookie Gilchrist's apartment, and I get a call from George Halas. And George Halas says to me, he says, Milt, he says, we'd like you to come to play for the Chicago Bears. And I said, well, Mr. Halas, I said, I don't know if I want to play in the States, and I don't know if I want to go through this nonsense anymore. And he said to me, he says, I understand thoroughly. He said, I know exactly what you're talking about. If it will interest you. I said, yeah, it interests me, you know. I said, but, you know, I don't want to drag my wife and my son through this kind of stuff anymore. And he says, well, I want you to know that the Chicago Bears will pay you more than what you made at the Cleveland Browns. And I want you to know that the Chicago Bears will give you a 3-year no-cut contract. Now, the rest of this you have to listen very carefully to, because at that time I was very young and I was a very honorable kid. My dad has always taught me, if you give your word, you keep it. And I told him, I said, Mr. Halas, I can't come to play for you this year. I've signed a contract with the Hamilton Tiger Cats. So he said to me, he said, well, okay, he said, but if you decided to leave that league, nobody is going to come after you. And I said, nobody, what do you mean? I said, they're going to come after me for contract money and that type of thing. He said, whatever they come after you for, as far as that's concerned, he said, we'll get back to them. He said, but we'll get you the finest lawyers in the country if they come after you with a lawyer for something else.
So he's saying you can break your contract with the Hamilton team and come to the Bears and we'll pay your legal expenses.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He said, we'll take care of everything. And I said to him, I said, Mr. Halas, I wish I could. And he says, well, what's holding you back? I said, Mr. Halas, I gave these people my word. I signed the contract and said I would play for them. And George Halas said to me, he said, I respect that. And he said, well, if you ever make up your mind that you would like to leave from up there and come down back to the States, he said, the Chicago Bears will have a contract for you. And I just never took it.
How many years did you play in Hamilton?
I played up in Canada 8 years. I went through the same kind of nonsense and stuff, though. You know, I came to Hamilton Tiger Cats the first four times I put my hand on the football, I ran all the way for touchdown. First four times, okay?
Yeah.
I didn't run much after that.
Really? You didn't get the ball?
No. As long as we were winning, I didn't run. You know, and it was the same. I mean, we were dealing with American Southern coaches.
Oh, okay.
So it was the same kind of nonsense. You know, so you fought your heart out and you played as best you could. If your team was winning, you didn't play. You didn't, you know, and I still played both ways most of the time. And then one day, I guess they traded me. Where did they trade me to? They traded me to Edmonton, I think. And I went out to Edmonton to play, and I was playing, and I intercepted a pass, and a guy ran me down, and I said, that's it. That's it.
You'd lost a step.
I've had enough. I went inside, and also I told them that I had they were interviewing me, and I said I had a very bad sprained ankle at Cleveland. And the doctor said, well, let's take an X-ray of it. So they took an X-ray of it. And they said, your ankle wasn't sprained. Your ankle was broke, separated, and dislocated. Mm. And that happened in Cleveland at the second game we had. And I played all year. Paul Brown told me it was nothing but a bad sprain. Huh. See, back in those days, we didn't get our own doctor like these kids get today. And everything, those are the things we didn't know.
Yeah, and the team physician was going to take the team side of things. They weren't going to protect you. They were going to just throw you out there.
Well, they would tell the coach, and the coach could tell you whatever lie he wanted to tell you.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And then I go up to Canada. I got traded to Edmonton. That's what it was. The season that had ended where someone ran me down. Then they traded me to Edmonton. And I said, well, let me go one last season. So I drove out to Edmonton and so forth, and the doctor x-rayed me and everything. And he looked at me, and he said, if you get hit on that ankle again, he says, you're going to be crippled for the rest of your life. So I took my jock strap and my shoes, and I walked into the coach's office. I put them on his desk. I said, there's a gift for me. I'm through. And I walked out. That was it.
That first contract, though, you had in Hamilton, was it for multiple years or 1 year?
It was for 1 year.
So why didn't you go to Chicago after that first year in Canada?
I don't know. I when I realized that I was going through this kind of prejudice stuff up there, I didn't want to go through it down in the States again because I had moved my family up there. I had a little boy, and we had moved up to Canada, and things were, you know, things were good. People were decent, you know what I mean? I didn't have to worry about could I sit in this restaurant or not sit in that one, you know, type of idea. In fact, at one time I ran a crew for an encyclopedia company, and I was up in the northern part of Canada, and some guy said something to one of the kids that was with me. And they weren't kids, we were young men.
Yeah.
Okay. Somebody said something to the kids, and I said, well, why don't you leave him alone? And the guy turned around and he said, nigger, I'm not talking to you. So I said, what'd you say? And I got out of the car, and I walked over to him, you know, and he was sitting in his car. I said, what'd you say? And he said, Darky, you heard what I was saying. And I said, what did you say? And he rolled down his window, and I jammed my fist down his throat, you know. So the next, we're sitting in a restaurant eating. Next thing I know, the amount of police come. And they said, did you have an altercation with so-and-so and so-and-so? I said, I did. And so they said, well, you have to come down to the court. So I went down to the court. And the next day, the judge, you know, we had to go in front of the judge. And this kid had, the side of his face was all black and blue, you know. So the judge said, well, why would you hit him? I said, so I told the judge what he said. Call me a nigger, and he called me a nigger again. And I asked him one more time, and he repeated it the third time, and I thought that was enough. And the judge looked at the kid, and he says, well, I kind of think you were asking for it. Case dismissed.
Ah, which may not have happened in the States.
No. And I said to myself, maybe I'll live here.
Yeah.
So I lived up in Canada for a while, and I did better at selling encyclopedias than I did playing football as far as money was concerned.
Really? That was your off-season job? You sold encyclopedias, huh?
Oh, yeah. I was good at it. I was good at it.
Which encyclopedia was it?
Collier Encyclopedia.
Okay. Campbell starts an alternative school back in New Jersey when One-on-One continues. We're back on One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with Olympian Milt Campbell. His competitive nature has been on display in a lot of different ways, in track and field, football, at a poker table, even in his dreams. So in 1967, you're retired and you leave Canada to go back to New Jersey and you start a community center and alternative school.
Right.
That's a pretty big step. I mean, that's not what most retired athletes do.
Well, you know, I was retired as an athlete, but I still needed to work at something, and riots broke out in my hometown. And, you know, you kind of feel that you want to kind of get in between this thing to kind of quell it. You know that you can't quell it, but at the same time, you know, I was able to talk to the chief of police and state police and still be able to wander and talk to my community. And I was able to arrange food, put a perimeter around Plainfield, and I was able to bring in food for those of the, you know, people that got burned out and that type of stuff. And, you know, a few things like that. And I was able to meet with some of the community people, and which I had to put them in their place the same way that, you know, you put everybody else in their place, you know, because, you know, some of them said something about my wife being white, and I said, that's my responsibility, and that is my relationship. You open your mouth about it again, we'll do whatever we have to do. You know, you're just not going to do it. And I said, you have to realize one thing. I'm not being called a nigger because I'm a Baptist or because I'm married to a white woman. I'm called a nigger because I'm black. And I said, and that's what I'm fighting against. Okay? And so, you know, now they understood me. Now they understood me, and, you know, and they realized they could trust me. So you do the best you can to hope that stuff would go away. So one of the things that I thought that we needed in Newark, we needed our own schools. You know, we needed to be able to say our kids can go over here to a private school and learn something about being black. And so I was one of the co-founders for Chad School. I basically wasn't a curriculum writer or anything like that, but I raised the funds because I had communication between blacks and whites.
Right.
And I had a reputation that my word was bond, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And went from there, and I built the community center because the kids weren't going down to the YMCA. For some reason, they wouldn't leave out of their community to go down to the Y. And some of these kids lived in a 4-block radius of their house. Some of them had never been downtown except his mom had taken them downtown to buy a pair of jeans or something, you know? And so when they said, well, we got the boys' club. We went over to the boys' club, and there's not a lot of kids there. I built a community center. I got 500 kids in it. And if I throw a party or a dance or something like that, 500 kids show up.
Is it still there, the community center?
No, I actually gave the community center to the to Chad School, which was the school that we developed.
Right.
Does Chad School might have wound up, I'm not sure, but they might have wound up selling the school to the Muslim organization that was there in order to build another science center or something like that.
Okay.
But very good school. We built all of our kids. We used the Cureton reading plan. Most of our kids were reading when they were 5 years old. And then what happened to the school, it was like a preschool. What happened to it, the kids would go into regular school, and they would regress. So we realized we had to start building the school to a first grade, a second grade, and so forth on. And then we got to the point where our kids would graduate from our grammar school, and all of them would go into private schools. and all of them were passing. We're doing great. It was a great adventure.
That's a great contribution. So as you look back on your athletic career, are you kind of glad you faced the obstacles you did? Or do you feel like you could have done, you know, better? Or do you wish you wouldn't have had to deal with some of the things you did?
No, you know, it was the times.
Yep.
That was the times. We had a barrier to break down, and you had a choice. You either get into this or you go hide for the rest of your life and never show the world what you got. You know what I mean? I was determined, regardless of what doors I had to break down or not, I was determined to stand there in front of you and say, I am the best athlete in the world. Give me a shot to prove it, and I'll prove it to you. I remember, I tell you a story, Wally Choice used to go to Indiana University also. He's from Montclair, New Jersey. And we used to compete against each other all the time. And then he went to Indiana, and then I came along a year behind him at Indiana. And we had played spring football. And then Wally didn't play. I had played spring football. And I told Wally, I don't know what I'm going to do after spring football. He said, well, the only thing to do is in 8 days they're going to have the Big Ten championship. And I said, oh, I think I'll go run in the Big Ten championship and win the hurdles. He said, man, this is the Big Ten. You cannot come out of football and then 8 days later go into a track meet and win anything. He said, this is the Big Ten. You're going to be running against Abe Woodson and so forth and so forth. And I said, so what? So he turned around and he said to me, he said, all right. He said, I'll get in the car and I'll drive to Ohio State and I'll see. Well, of course, I won the Big Ten championship. I won with a Big Ten record. And he looked at me and he said, I'll never doubt you again. And just walked away. But, it was not so much that I needed to prove it to you. These things motivated me. For you to tell me I couldn't do it made me want to do it even more. There wasn't a point. I'm almost 80 years old now, so I can brag about it now. But it wasn't a point to brag in those days. It was a point to say to myself, I've got it. I'm willing to pay the price for it. Go do it. And that's the way I was.
Okay, Milt, I got a theme question I've asked everybody that I've talked to for this show. When you are sleeping at night and dreaming, do you have dreams of competing in either football or track and field?
It's funny you ask that. I'll tell you a story about what's happened to me. Over the last years, as I said, I'll be 79 this year. I ran into prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been battling that, and it's come back and forth a couple of times. So the last time that it came back, they put me on Lupron, and that began to lower my testosterone, and then they put me on chemotherapy. And the Lupron took me down to the point where I started getting neuropathy in my feet and in my fingertips, and my nerves in my legs started going funny. And then after a while, I had no strength in my right leg at all. So my nerves in my right leg have been gone. And now it's slowly, slowly coming back. They told me it'd take about 2.5 to 3 years before it would come back. So it's been a year now. And my legs are beginning to come back, and I'm beginning to work on it and everything. So the other night, I'm laying in bed. And my wife wakes me up, and she says, Milt, wake up. You're running. And I woke up before I stopped doing what I was doing. And I was literally laying on my back, pumping both of my knees up as high as I can, driving my arms, you know.
Oh, wow.
He said, what are you doing? I said, I just went over my last hurdle.
That is great. So,
and when I woke up, I knew I was doing what she said, you know.
Uh-huh.
So it was interesting that she said that. Yes, I do dream about it.
Is it hard to sleep the night before you're going to compete in the decathlon in the Olympics?
It's hard to sleep the night before I'm going to compete at a poker game. I am still that competitive.
Really?
I want to win. You know? And I just think someone else can learn how to play poker and win. I can learn how to play poker and win. You
okay.
Know? I do quite well. I do pretty well.
One-on-one with Milt Campbell continues in a moment. Welcome back to One on One. I'm Mark Monteith. Hey, thanks to Mel Campbell for telling his story. You know, I bet most of the people listening to this program hadn't even heard of Milt Campbell. But he's without a doubt one of the world's greatest athletes of all time. Seriously. Who else do you know who's won Olympic gold in a decathlon, set a world record in the hurdles, played in the NFL and CFL, and been inducted into the Swimming Hall of Fame? Obviously, nobody. He would have received a lot more recognition locally if he'd finished his career at IU, but as he said, he'd already won an Olympic gold medal and had a chance to play in the NFL. Hard to say no to that opportunity. And by the way, if you think you might want to buy an Olympic gold medal someday, Milt says he'll sell his. It's in a bank vault somewhere. And the memories of the accomplishment mean a lot more to him than the medal. I found that's the way it is with all athletes. Now, if you missed part of this episode or last week's episode with Milt Campbell, or want to check out one of the others in the one-on-one library, go to the website at 1070thefan.com. Click on shows, click on weekly shows, and click on the one-on-one link for access to all the podcasts. I can be reached by email at mark@1070thefan.com, and my Twitter handle is @MarkMonteith. Now, next week, I'll be back with another gold medal winner from the 1956 Olympics who also attended IU, long jumper Greg Bell. He's still a practicing dentist, by the way. That'll be next week, right here on 1070 The Fan.